Came back. Oh, yeah, from when?
No, I went down just before and see if
they could order one. Oh, yeah, right. Yeah, we have to borrow this one. Because the one we have is had someone else and they haven't returned it. So,
right.
But this one doesn't seem to have any. One, two, three, no. There doesn't seem to be any sort of connection here.
Okay, so do we have another one of this? Do we have another one?
Yeah, but we don't have it. Someone else brought it in, and they haven't heard it yet. So, if someone asks questions, I might just have to repeat them again.
Okay, no problem. I will repeat and I will leave it. Okay. So,
so PanCache is currently is a PhD candidate in our bimetric lab. So it's in your second year in your PhD award.
Yeah.
Yes. So it's going to talk about the face quality assessment on smartphone.
Okay. Cool. Okay. Hello everybody and welcome to this lecture. So today I'll be talking about face image quality assessment for smartphone biometrics. My name is Pankaj Vasnik and I'm a PhD student in Norwegian Biometrics Lab. I joined in 2016, and this is my second year of PhD. So I'm a part of project called as SWAN, and what I work today I'll be presenting it is related to the project SWAN. So in this topic, I will be talking about face recognition in particular. Then what are the features of face recognition? Then what type of challenges are there when you do face recognition on smartphone? And then we will talk about some quality assessment and the evaluation criteria, followed by another approach what we recently tried, which is nothing but the deep learning approach for the same task of face quality assessment. Okay, so what is face recognition system? So let's broadly, a face recognition system can be shown by this block diagram. So you have an image of a person, then you find out the face in that image, localize the face, that we usually call as face detection or localization. Then you do some image processing on that face image, and then you can extract some feature which can be utilized to recognize the person from other person. So that is a typical block diagram of a face recognition system. So what are the features of a conventional face recognition system? So conventional face recognition systems, they have a constant environment. Constant, I mean, like, you are given some set of instructions how to deal with the system. You need to stand properly in front of the camera. You have to interact with the system as per the given protocol. Then there are a lot of, there are particular ISO, IEC standards developed for the conventional FRS, in short. So there are standards for quality of the face recognition images. There are standards for the evaluation criteria. There are standards for the evaluation of the performance of these such systems. Again, these type of systems are benchmarked and tested by the government organizations like NIST and etc. And the application areas for the face recognition system, like conventional face recognition system and smartphone face recognition systems, are different. Mainly, the conventional FRSs are made for security purposes, access control, border, automatic border control, and stuff like that. So they are really well engineered, and they are really rigorously tested. Whereas, on the other hand, if you see like the smartphone-based face recognition systems have none of these type of features. Who makes the apps? No one knows. Sometimes an unknown developer can also make the face recognition app. No one tests it. There are no standards for the smartphone-based face recognition. There is nothing. So that's what makes the challenge. That's what makes this area challenging. Like, because when you don't have any guide to follow, then you are running into the wild. And moreover, what are we dealing with? We are dealing with selfies. And look at them. They are really, they make really hard for face recognition algorithm likeness. You have a lot of issues with illumination. You have issues with the pose. Pose is basically the face angle. Or if you see your face, the axis which makes angle, we usually call it as a pose. Then you have expressions. Then you have like really, really difficult, illumination problems. And if you see like that, why these type of problems can occur? Let's say you have a smartphone with a, let's say nowadays we see that iPhone is coming with Face ID. So if you have integrated that Face ID with your Apple Pay and now you are buying something else, you are on the road. So I don't think so that you are going to look for a very good background and very constant environment that you can take a good picture so that you can have a better recognition performance. So that's what it makes challenging. Like, you have a lot of challenging images, and so quality plays really important role in that sense. Like, because the quality of any face image is directly proportional to the recognition performance of that system. And in smartphone domain, or let's say when you are doing any biometrics with smartphone, the world changes, and there are so many different types of, you know, like distortions. You have the less control over the, or you have the unconstant environment, which can add the lot of face angles. You have distortions due to low light. You have distortions due to the out of focusing or shaking of the hand. You have distortions due to the images taken at different positions. Like someone can take the selfie from near, someone can take it from a bit farther away. And this type of behavior with the system introduces the perspective distortion and the distortion in the face geometry. And then the face recognition algorithm faces really difficult time in that case. So this was the main purpose, motivated us to do a face quality assessment for smartphones and see what are the standards are made for conventional face recognition system, how do they perform, or how do these images respond to those standards like. So I'll be talking about those standards too. So what was the contribution to this work? So what we did is we proposed a unified face recognition system with quality assessment. We evaluated the system with the already developed ISO standards. They aren't meant for smartphone, but we saw how do they respond to the ISO standards, these images. And then we proposed a new metric to improve the quality assessment. We felt like that. Few of the image characteristics which are defined in the ISO standards are redundant or maybe can be replaced by a simplified formula. So we tried that too. So this was the face recognition system with the quality assessment. You have a smartphone, you capture your image, then you do face detection. Then you do quality assessment. If the quality is enough or it's good, you go further for the feature extraction and then recognition. If it is not, then you discard the image or notify user that please do redo the capture or something like that. So in this work, the ISO standards we considered is 29794, part 1 and 5. So part 1 defines that the quality of any sample what we use for the facial recognition or any, let's say, fingerprint recognition, the quality contributes positively or negatively to the recognition performance of the system. Similarly, part 5 of the 29794 defines the methodologies, or in particularly I would say face quality assessment algorithms, to verify the image follows the ISO standards or not, or you can check the conformance or not, because most of the face recognition systems are deployed in government restricted areas as well as at airports, at high secured areas, so they need to follow some standards and they need to go through some sort of very robust protocols. So 29794 defines a different type of characteristics for face image. There are static characteristics like injuries and scars on or ethnic group. There are dynamic characteristics like closed eyes, open mouth or expressions, as well as there are characteristics which are related to the image. And as an image processing guy, I always deal with the characteristics related to the images. So the considered metrics for this work were lighting symmetry. Lighting symmetry is nothing but when you take an image, you see how the illumination is spread across the facial regions of the subject. Then you have pose symmetry, what type of angles are there, is there having any pose in that image. Then image brightness, contrast, and global contrast factor. This is also another measure of contrast, but at very minor level. So you have image contrast, which is at overall image. You scan for one shot, and then you measure the contrast for that image. And in case of global contrast factor, what you do basically is you calculate the capture at one scale, then you scale down the image, again you calculate the captures, again scale down and again captures, and there is some very complex mathematical formula which does the rest of the thing, and it gives you some number. Then there is exposure, blur, and sharpness. And then we proposed a metric for vertical edge density based metric, and basically we did it to replace these two matrices our metrics from the ISO standards, which is like lighting symmetry and pose symmetry. How can we do that, or how, why we could do it? I will explain in next slide, basically. So the edges from the nasal part and the border of the face can be utilized to, let's say, replace, or can be utilized to precisely define the lighting symmetry and pose symmetry of a facial image. How can we do? If we have a very straight image, there is no pose. So when you take an edge map of that image, or when you do like aging of that image, you have more edges or more vertical edges you can very finely see in that image. You can quantify those edges, and then you can have, let's say, some measure for those edges. And when you have, let's say, pose in the image, so one part of face might have more, or you get like proper regular image, like edges, but you might not get for the second part of the face. Similarly, for the, if you have pose like this, maybe you can get the edges in the border of that, but nasal area edges will be lesser in that case. So you can quantify basically based on that. Similarly, for the lighting symmetry, you can have the same analogy. Like if you have uneven lighting, let's say you have lighting from one side, so there will be like a more brighter area in the one facial region, let's say left side of the face or something like that. Then what happens is, like, when you take what are the edges basically? Edges are nothing but the intensity differences. So when you have the very highlight on one side, so you have very less difference in the intensities of pixel intensities, though you don't get more edges in that case. And if you have, let's say, very nicely illuminated area, or let's say nicely illuminated face in the image, so that time you have like different types of pixel values, which gives you better edge map. And how do you calculate it? You can just take the gradient of image on x direction and y direction, then calculate the magnitude of that gradient at each and every pixel. Like, let's say XY is the location of the pixel, you calculate magnitude at IX and IY. Similarly, you calculate the phase at XY location. And to consider the vertical edges, how do you find the vertical edges then? Then you need to have some criteria. So we have added the criteria as the edges which are like greater than 30 degree and lesser than 120 degree angle. A phase angle can be considered as the vertical edge pixel, basically. So these, how did we reach to these numbers? You can also have your own numbers, but we did a lot of experiments, and we found out that these numbers are performing well for the overall performance of the system. And then basically these are empirical values. So, and later you calculate the number of pixels which are belonging to the vertical edges, and then divide by the total number of edge pixels, and you get the edge density. So now you have all matrix. So you have the, let's say, 8 matrix form here, which are we considered, and then you have this vertical edge density. What will you do with this? Let's say if you come to me, if I'm the algorithm, and if you come to me, give face image, and if I'm giving you 9 values, then it's meaningless. Or maybe it's meaningful, if you really know that what is the lighting symmetry and what is that. But it is really confusing with 9 values, how whether the image is good or bad. So you need to have a unified framework which can either fuse these values and or come up with some single number. Let's say in between 0 to 100, which will say like that. 0 is the lowest quality and the 100 is the highest quality. So for this reason, what we did is, like, we considered n number of classifiers. So let's say you have C1 to CN classifiers, and the task of these classifiers is only to bin these images into good and bad. And then you take the ISO metric as a feature vector, and then you train some classifier. So we train random forest classifier because it gives you good probability towards the reference class. Let's say your reference class is a good image. And whenever you pass any test image to the random forest classifier, it will give you probability related to the good class or good image classes. So that's why we had used a random forest here. And how did we basically did our experiment? So for doing our experiment, we collected a database of 109 subjects with 22 images per subject. Huge database and really tedious hard work. So, if you see like that, we tried to capture all type of images, or we we considered water means like when I was designing the experiment, so I that's what I came up with. So I came up with some pose value or pose in the face, then some lighting conditions, as well as some perspective distortion. The last three images are taken at the different angle, or the, let's say, like subject will interact with the capturing device at different distances. And then we tried to analyze our proposed system with this data. So what we did is like 48 subjects from the session 2, we used it for training the random forest classifier. So in this case, we used the 48 subjects data as our training data, and remaining data was used for the testing.
Is there a time difference between these two sessions?
Yeah, it was 7 days. Actually, location I did not change because I did this data collection in one college and they had given me one room where I can meet with subjects. And
so
it was almost identical. That's why I picked up randomly 48 subjects. And what we did is basically I took the second session data so that because the first session they did not know how to interact with it. But for the second session, they knew that, how to interact. So there will be like less errors, you know, like interaction with the system. So that's why I took like basically a second data to train the random forest so that I can have like more, let's say, or the accurate good images and accurate bad images. So how was the experiment designed is basically you have the M individuals and you have N samples per individuals. To analyze the quality, what you should do is like each time you reject one sample and calculate the FNMR of the system, so fall non-match rate of the system. Basically, FNMR is nothing but the rate of falsely non-matched for the same person. Like if you are the person and I'm not matching you, if I'm the face recognition system, that is counted into the false non-match rate. So, and then you reject one sample and recalculate the FNMR, reject another sample, recalculate the FNMR. And basically FNMR is a type of error in the system. So based on the error versus rejection, percentage of rejection, we can formulate a system or we can model a system called as like ERC-based system, or let's say error versus reject curve-based system, to analyze the performance of the quality score. So what is ERC curve basically? It predicts the performance of quality algorithm in terms of false non-match rate. In another way, it helps to reject the low quality samples from the system. And what is expected, or how you will understand, like the, or what is the expected behavior of ERC? Let's say you develop one quality algorithm. So whenever you pass one image to that algorithm, it gives you some value between 0 to 100. If it is really good algorithm, if it is really good in sense, like if it is really giving you lower values for the bad images and higher values for the good images, in that case, whenever you reject a sample, the FNMR of the system will decrease rapidly. That's what the ERC calculations are. And this type of evaluation criteria is given by National Institute of Standards and Technology, NIST, I guess, for they had given it for the fingerprint images. And then we adopted it for the face images too. And basically the ERC curve is nothing but graph between FNMR and rejection of genuine samples. And to quantify the decrease in the FNMR, we used area under curve and partial area under curve. So why partial area under curve? So for partial area under curve, we only consider the 20% of the curve. So let's say you have the 100% of the curve, or full curve, you just consider the area which falls under the 20% of the curve. And why do you need the partial area curve? Because in practice, there is any face recognition system or any enrollment for a face recognition system who rejects, let's say, 100% of the samples. Like I'm asking someone to come and enroll yourself for face recognition, and then I'm rejecting all of the samples, and again I'm asking them to come. We don't do these things. So usually what we do is like we reject the samples, which are like 20% or 10%. So you, when you model any biometric system, you define these values upfront. You say like that, I will go with 10% of the FNMR for, let's say, some false match rate also. And then you design the biometric system. So this is like system level design, but FNMR is closely related for the algorithms. Okay, so how does this ERC curve look like? So if you see on x-axis, it is a fraction of genuine samples rejected. On y-axis, it is false match rate. And the dotted line basically is a theoretical based. Why it is 0.1, landing on 0.1, I am not really sure, because in NIST paper, they had not really or clearly described about it, why the theoretical based falls at 0.1. But we tried to follow all the, we were trying to have the conformance with the ISO standards and the methodologies followed by the standard institutions, so we actually used it as a 0.1 here. So what is expected from this curve? Or if you really have a good algorithm, how will it behave? Basically, it will behave like a let's say dotted line. Or what we can say in practice, we cannot get it, but for let's say any system or any quality algorithm, if it is a good algorithm, you will expect that your curve is more near to the origin. And then you calculate these two metrics. Again, we define for it. So these are just numbers to quantify the decrease in the FNMR. If you see, all of the curves are like decreasing curves. So, and the smaller graph shows the full curve, actually. And the bigger or the zoomed version of that graph is like 30% what I'm displaying here. So these quality scores what we had calculated here are, we use like Verilook SDK. It is a commercial SDK. So we had like quality scores from Verilook SDK, and we had quality scores from each and every ISO standard characteristic. This is like more or less we just can see like how the trend is going on, or are the really characteristics given in the standards really, do they really mean what they are written for? And what we found is like the lighting symmetry had like area under curve of 0.027 and the 20% area under curve of 0.001. Whereas for Samsung database, we observed the edge density, whatever we had proposed, had good values, like 0.03 and 0.003. So later what we did is, basically we calculated the overall system performance. So you have the ISO metric and you have the random forest, and you generate one quality score. Then you have the COTS. COTS is nothing but the commercial system. You have another quality score. And then we replace the lighting symmetry and pose symmetry, and we have with random, and including with random forest, you have another quality score. So you have three algorithms, and this is how they perform. And what we found out is like ISO plus edge density with random forest was performing well for Samsung database, whereas for iPhone 6 database, the commercial system performed well. So these were the conclusions from this study. Like 5%, there wasn't any rapid decrease in the FNMR for 5% sample rejections, as well as up to the 20% sample rejections, FNMR of the system was 0.05, which was really okay. And the proposed quality scheme with which was like ISO and the third one, which was the proposed one, was having nearly equal or let's say better performance for the commercial face recognition system algorithm. Or every face recognition SDK comes with the face quality assessment also. But they do not disclose their algorithms. How do they do the quality or what? They just give you some number. So, okay, so that was the study, and we published this study in IWBF 2017, Coventry, UK. Later, after this study, how much time I have? It's like 5-10 minutes? 10 minutes, right? Okay. So, we tried to analyze the same problem with the contemporary, or let's say, state-of-the-art research work. So, as we know that deep learning performs really well with the any type of data which includes images, video, audio, and text data. So we thought that why not to try it with the face quality assessment. So I will talk a little bit overview. Now I will explain about the second approach, which is basically the deep learning approach. So what is deep learning basically? So deep learning is nothing but, this is also a type of artificial neural network, just you have more number of hidden layers. And like really more number of hidden layers. So more the number of hidden layers, you have deeper the network. So, and in case of normal artificial neural network, you have 2 or 3 hidden layers. In case of deep learning, you might have hundreds, tens of them, as you like, if you have computational power. What are the advantages of deep learning? So advantages are like it's highly accurate and useful for data consisting of images, audio, and text, as well as feature extraction is an automatic process in case of deep learning. In case of normal machine learning, you need to do the feature extraction, what we call as the handcrafting of the features or some algorithm for feature extraction. But in case of deep learning, when you train the network, it learns the features automatically. And it's end-to-end learning process. Some of the problems are like it requires huge data set to train, like really huge, like millions of images, if you really need a good accuracy from the algorithm. And it requires really high computing power, like GPUs of 16 gigs or, I don't know, more than that, and based on your funding. And what are the popular networks till now? There is this AlexNet, then VGG16, VGG19. There is Google Inception version 3. And popular frameworks for deep learning are TensorFlow, Caffe, Theano. If somebody wants to try, you can go to their websites. They have really good documentation. You can go and try some sample code. It's amazing. Okay, what is convolutional neural network? So CNN is the most popular deep learning algorithm. It is one of the algorithms from deep learning. It mainly consists of 5 parts. Let's say one is convolution, another is pooling, then you have ReLU, then you have fully connected layers, and you have softmax layer. So if you see the block diagram, I tried to map all these parts in that block diagram. So convolution, let's say the first block diagram or the second diagram, we can see you have a filter bank here. You have some image processing filters, like 3x3 filters, 5x5 filters, if you know a bit of image processing. So, and convolution is one of the operation with the images, what we do basically. So you have the input image, you have this, let's say N number of filters or filter bank. You convolve these filters with this image, you get some set of images. What do you do basically? That's called as the convolution part. So that is the convolution part. Then it comes the pooling. So once you did this operation, what you do? You reduce the image size by 2, basically. It's a non-linear size reduction. Why do we do it? Like basically, in the first layer, you learn the major features like color, shape, and edges of the objects, basically, in this layer. And then there is no need to learn again those things. So you can, that might be a redundant information. So you can reduce the size of the image. It will reduce your computational power. It will reduce your number of computations. Then you reduce.
How do you measure the size of the image?
Uh-huh.
How do you measure the size? You use some rows, some columns?
Yeah, basically we take like max pooling. So you take like 4x4 pixels, whichever let's say pixel has a higher value, you take that value, replace those 4 pixels with that value. And similarly, you can do it for. But you already got those features in your first layer.
Does that mean that actually color information is
No, not necessarily. There will be some color information. Yeah, but maybe color will be reduced, but your overall shape will be same. And you can, again, in that layer, you might learn in more finer way the shape. And then again, you have ReLU. ReLU is nothing but it's a kind of activation function. So if you have the negative values in your, let's say, previous layer or any layer, you can apply ReLU operation. It will make zero, the negative values will be zero, and the positive values will be maintained as it is. So this is also done for faster learning process, because deep learning is a very, really deep learning process, I would say. And it takes really a long time. So to faster the process and to make it more easier, you can have a simpler activation functions. And there are still some, some discussions are going on why ReLU performs better than the sigmoid function or other functions. Because earlier in the, let's say, traditional artificial neural network, we used to use sigmoid or tanh, I guess, tan, hyperbolic tan, yes. And then you have some layers are called as like fully connected layers. So the prior, so if you have, let's say, what is mean by a fully connected layer? So every node, or let's say every neuron in this layer is connected with the previous one. So every neuron is connected. That's why it is called as fully connected. After fully connected layer, you can have several ReLU layers, or you can even have more than two fully connected layers. Depends on you, how you design your network. But after that, you have something called as softmax layer. So softmax layer is nothing but it is a normalized exponential function. And what it does basically, let's say you have 1024 values here in this layer, and you have, let's say, 10 or 5 classes here. Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You have 5 classes, and you have, let's say, 100 nodes here. So what softmax basically does is like it distributes the probability, or it gives you the probability for these 5 classes from this, let's say, 100 input nodes or something like that. So that's the typical block diagram of any convolutional neural network. And what is transfer learning? So transfer learning is basically, so you have some network which is already trained on some other type of data. Let's say in case of ImageNet, the most popular database what was used in the deep learning. So image database was meant for 1,000 classes, and this was meant for the different type of objects. And they had like millions of images for every object. And let's say you have any network, let's say AlexNet or Google Inception or anything, you already have trained it with ImageNet. So how can you reuse those net? Because it's a process of 15 days of training or 20 days of training. So you don't want to go again to train your network for 20 days. Again, you don't have, I don't think so, someone can have like millions of images for your specific task. Let's say I'm doing for face recognition image. It means like, I don't think I will find like million of people to, and there are millions of images to do this task. So it's always better to get some information from the previously trained networks. Why you can do that? Because these networks are also, basically you will do the same operations. You will try to find out the edges. You will try to find out the color in the image. You will try to find out the shapes and complex shapes from the image. So you can reuse that information, which is already done from other operations. And you can try like how your data performs with the previously trained networks. That is basically the transfer learning. How it is achieved? So you have input data set, let's say ImageNet in this case. ImageNet, and you have some network. You have, let's say, AlexNet here. You trained it. You have some fully connected layers in that AlexNet. And you have softmax layer. You cut down this softmax layer. You cut down the softmax layer. Reuse this, let's say, here till these two yellow lines, or let's say layers. And transfer the, use the, basically, what is mean by reusing is nothing but this is neural network. So we have matrices of weights, and we have the matrices of biases, right? So you reuse those weights, whatever you had calculated earlier for that database, and pass it for, and use the same values for your data. So now in this case, you have the, let's say for me, we have quality database. So I have like quality here. So I will reuse this everything, and I will process my image I will try to do the softmax for my images with my number of classes. I had only two classes, good and bad. And then whatever is the, and through the backpropagation, I will only update these layers. I will not update any of the previously used layers. So I will only update last two final connected layers and softmax layer. And that's how you can map any problem which to any, means like any, you can use any network which is previously trained for any type of problem. Yeah, just last one. So, and it is faster and, okay. It's faster and easier than training whole database. And, but the only, there is one condition I want to mention it like that. If you have like, your database is like smaller number of images if you have, it's good to use. If you too have like million images, there is no need to. You can go for like retraining completely for yourself and then you can have like more accurate results for that. And also like task A, let's say, task A and task B should have like same type of data, like image to image. So that's how we did like, so what we did is like we used like 5 databases. And we created like 2 classes. We've been like into the good and bad images. And we retrained almost like 4 networks, like AlexNet, Inception, VGG 19 and 16. And we tested against the 5 test databases, ABC, Checkpoint database, SE, Face database, and the Samsung and Apple database. And then we compared against 3 quality algorithms, Brisk, Blindness, and if you see the ERC curves, okay, I will now move directly to the end. But if you see everywhere, the AlexNet and Inception performed well. Transfer learning task gave us really better results. If you see in the table also, you can see for ABC, Inception was better. For Apple, AlexNet was better. For Checkpoint also, AlexNet was better. Samsung also, AlexNet was better. And for SFS, Inception performed well. Than any, like, even with the Verilook SDK, what we earlier see, like, that the performance was, Verilook was better every time. So, in short, only one line conclusion, deep learning performs well as blind face quality algorithm. It's data independent. You can train any type of, let's say, face images for quality, take it from any type of databases and train for your database or retrain with your database and I guess it really works well. Yeah. Questions? Yeah.
So we have time for questions.
Yeah. No, it's not working. That's not working. But you can take, I will repeat it. Okay. I have to repeat it.
And they were presenting a graphical user authentication system.
Graphical so user authentication.
Yeah.
Okay.
So at the beginning of the introduction of that, those authors of that paper stated, coming to biometrics, they stated that in general it's not really, it doesn't get a lot of acceptance for the users because of intrusiveness and because of privacy concerns.
Mm-hmm.
And also that in general biometrics are slow, expensive, and not. Yes.
But.
That's what I would like to comment since you're working on the book. What do you do?
I would say biometrics are in, let's say, okay, the question is how in general biometrics is related, I would say. Overview about the biometrics. So. I would say like that biometrics, okay, before a few years, it was really expensive and really exclusive, only meant for some, I don't know, access control doors or border control and something like that. But now you see face ID is coming with Apple 10. So we have face recognition on phone. We already had it in iris recognition in, I guess, Note 8. Samsung Note 8 has literally IR-based iris recognition system. So it's getting day by day cheaper and day by day, I guess, adopted by people, I guess. So not that exclusive nowadays. Yeah, but there are privacy concerns, of course, but Yeah, that's still there. If even though your let's say for smartphone, I deal with smartphone biometrics. Even though your phone doesn't have biometrics and you lose it, still you have privacy concerns. Maybe if somehow they crack your password, I don't know, some jailbreak or something like that, they can get your data even. So that will happen, although with biometrics, with non-biometrics. So I don't see. But could be in a straightforward way, I would say. Of course, every business has a business strategy. So earlier phones did not add biometrics. Now phones have biometrics. So they are selling more. And yeah, could be even by business strategy. So. Yes.
And if you're having poor quality images, you generally will be forced to do something about the threshold, which will reduce security. In general, so you have to be more sloppy, okay? Or you have to be more flexible, okay? Poor image quality, if you're going to have acceptable user experience, you need to have a algorithm configured such that you accept.
Yeah.
Right. So in general, poor quality will make the operational people set the threshold to a low level such that you get more false acceptance.
Yeah.
Or false matching, as you call it. Okay. So in a sense, improving image quality through changing the threshold will in fact improve security, which is kind of is this, assuming I understand it correctly, is this something that is driving the quality work, that is to improve the security, or is it a different motivation that you have for working on image quality?
So, I would say, like, we are not considering security here. Basically, I'm being like more strict biometrician here. I would say if your image quality is low, you should reject it. You should not use it for the recognition purpose. You should directly reject that image and give some provision for user to redo the capture. Because as you said like that, if I'm accepting the, let's say, low quality images, there is a high chances of getting false match rate, higher false match rate, which will definitely cause problems. Like maybe based on the application scenario, let's say where there is a very high security need or necessity of high security, maybe there is already this thing there. If the quality is low, they just reject it. You have to redo the capture, or you need to have like really good features in your face image to go through that. So maybe for normal usage, I would say like every application area should have this, because even though if you want to unlock my phone, I won't like that thing. If someone can just unlock my phone even too, by taking some picture even from Facebook or something like my picture, like even low quality picture, I do not want that. So make life easier of the handlers or the who are like operators of the, let's say, biometric systems, they might have this threshold, manipulation of threshold, but there still should be some criteria, like up to what level you should accept it. And I guess, but in theoretical way, you should reject if it is really low quality image.
I'm just providing you with an argument suggesting that quality work is important for security.
Yeah, it's important. Like, and even though, like, means it's directly proportional to your recognition performance. Like, means if higher the quality, better the performance. If you don't have good quality images, definitely your system is not doing well, and you don't want that, basically. Yeah. Yeah. One question.
One question from students.
Yeah.
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 Try a question. gets better for each time you take a photo, right? The classification. Is that correct?
No, basically algorithm is only predicting the value of captured image.
Each time you take a picture, does the classification get better?
If you're, doesn't matter, like means if, let's say, whatever algorithm you developed, in case of this one, it just gives you quality value. It doesn't modify itself. But because this value is only assessment of the quality, after the assessment, there is a compensation for the quality. Let's say you really found out that bad quality or something, then you tweak your algorithm and to more better classification for good and bad, and then again you can have some more operations to counter, you know, like to have like countermeasures for the bad quality. You can, let's say there is a low contrast, you can do some contrast enhancement. If there is a, let's say, really high blur in the image, you can do some unsharp masking, and you can try to, you know, like make more sharper image. So these things will come maybe later after this, but this algorithm just predicts the quality. Thank you for the question. Okay.
Thanks for speaking.
Yeah.
So let's
yeah. Thank you all.
I don't know if you met before, but
no, I know you.
Yes.
Yeah, in NBL meeting.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, would you send the slides if they are not confidential to my email?
Okay.
You can send the PDF version if you want.
No problem.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay.
I think the explanation for this, what was it? DGG. That was very good. Both Alex and convolutional net.
Yeah.
So I don't think everybody understands this.
Yeah, actually, but time constraint was there, so but I had to.
Is there a reference that you used?
Actually, I created the image by myself. Like this is like all my, you know, like kind of understanding. So when I started working in deep learning, so I had gone through all this TensorFlow. I'm still using TensorFlow. Then I used Caffe. I'm still using that too. So I'm using three frameworks. Not four, like Theano also. So I have like Theano, Caffe, and TensorFlow, and MATLAB. So MATLAB I only use because it has like good data handling capability. But as I'm dealing with smartphone, so I use TensorFlow because TensorFlow has some C++ code, which you can port it to your phone and you can use it.
One of my PhD students, he does not for biometrics, but for capsule video endoscopy,
okay.
Swallowing pills, and
taking the images.
Inside,
okay, oh, that's cool.
Someone
from Color Image. That, okay, I know,
Islamic.
I know him.
You know,
yeah, I know him. Yeah.
So
yeah.
You can have some talk with him as well.
Okay, so he is also working in.
Anyone? Let's go for it. Yeah.